Fiendish technical difficulty of that last movement of Prokofiev's second violin concerto leave you breathless, dispatched with panache by Daniel Hope, performing with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Thomas Sondergaard. Wonderful performance, warmly appreciated here by the Prommers at the Royal Albert Hall. Daniel Hope coming back to the stage now to take another bow. He's being clapped by the orchestra as well, and he's thanking them. Cheers for a very fine violinist. A very interesting person indeed, Daniel Hope. He's been followed by camera crews all day. He's being filmed for a special feature on Proms Extra on BBC Two in a couple of weeks' time. A day in the life of a Proms artist and everything that that entails. And back on for the second time for another bow, this time with his friend and colleague, the conductor Thomas Sondergaard, who's bringing the whole orchestra to their feet. The two of them have performed this concerto together just last year in Aspen, they told me. And Daniel is a regular collaborator with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. He performed the Korngold Concerto with this orchestra just earlier this year. But now, as they have left the stage for the final time, the orchestra's getting to its feet as well to take a well-earned break after that. And it's time for the interval. It is time as well for a particularly prestigious Proms Plus Literary event, which was held earlier this evening just down the road at the Royal College of Music. And we can join Anne McElvoy.
John le Carré's name dominates spy fiction over the last half century. His geopolitical range is extraordinary. It covers the fierce secret combat of the Cold War and its impact on the societies who fought it, as well as the Russia of Perestroika, Latin America's skirmishes with American power, the moral quandaries of drug companies in Africa, and most recently, the ethical dilemmas thrown up in a turbulent world. It's 50 years since le Carré gave us his absorbing, compromised world of espionage in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, with its cast of flawed and opportunist characters robed in the grandeur of the Cold War. That and the many novels that have followed have won him a global audience of devoted readers, many in countries previously behind the Iron Curtain, which once separated his best-known character, Smiley, in his lair at the circus, from his enemy, the Soviet spy chief, Kahler. Le Carré hasn't been shy of commenting on real-life events either since the fall of the Berlin Wall as a vocal critic of American and British policy in the War on Terror. His latest novel, A Delicate Truth, takes us into the ethical conundrums of intelligence in a world more complex and arguably more unsettling than the divisions of superpower strife. Please welcome John Le Carré and our reader, John Shrapnel. John, give us a picture of the world in 1963 as you saw it when The Spy Who Came In from the Cold was published.
We were 15 years after the end of the Hot War, and West Germany, for all the attractive portraits that were painted of it, was an extremely disagreeable place to live in, I found. It was necessary to forget the past as a matter of doctrine, and the West German government and the systems, the administration, were peppered with unredeemed Nazis, as indeed they were in East Germany. But we forget almost now that Konrad Adenauer's principal advisor, Globke, had been party to drafting the Nuremberg Laws, which defined who was a Jew and who wasn't, made Jews use their original Hebraic names, and so on. We forget that the founder of West German intelligence, Reinhold Gehlen, had been Hitler's chief of intelligence on the Eastern Front. And in late 1944, when he saw which way the wind was blowing, he cut a deal with the Americans and turned over not simply his staff and himself, but his documents. And these became the nucleus of the BND in Pulach outside Munich.
The acronym for the West German Security
Service. Yeah, the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst outside Munich. So it was for a young, and I suppose you could almost say idealistic diplomat, living and operating from our embassy in Bonn, it was sometimes a very hard ticket to swallow, if you swallow a ticket. And I think I began to feel, in my own life, some kind of crisis, where I wondered how much we could be doing to preserve democracy and remain a democracy worth preserving. I became perhaps a little hysterical about that at the time.
Well, hysterical or not, it was also the driving narrative force in the book, wasn't it? And that sense
yes.
of heat and anger, which always struck me when I read it during the Cold War and afterwards, of everyone being walled in, the East Germans rather literally by the Berlin Wall, but everyone being trapped, including the Western
yes.
intelligence services. Well, I'd love to hear an extract from the book which reflects that so well, and it's from the beginning of The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. It sets up the story. John, read it for us.
Lemus picked up the binoculars. It was Karl. The figure was unmistakable, even at that distance, shrouded in an old Wehrmacht Macintosh, pushing his bicycle. He's made it, thought Lemus. He must have made it. He's through the document check, only currency and customs to go. Lemus watched Karl lean his bicycle against the railing and walk casually to the customs. Don't overdo it, he thought. At last, Karl came out, waved cheerfully to the man on the barrier, and the red and white pole swung slowly upwards. He was through. He was coming towards them. He had made it. Only the Vopo in the middle of the road, the white line, and safety. Then, totally unexpectedly, the searchlights went on, white and brilliant, catching Karl and holding him in their beam like a rabbit in the headlights of a car. There came the seesaw wail of a siren, the sound of orders wildly shouted. In front of Lemus, two policemen dropped to their knees. The East German sentry fired, quite carefully, away from them, into his own sector. The first shot seemed to thrust Karl forward, the second to pull him back. Somehow he was still moving, still on the bicycle, passing the sentry, and the sentry was still shooting at him. And then he sagged, rolled to the ground, and they heard, quite clearly, the clatter of the bike as it fell. Lemus hoped to God he was dead.
So, John le Carré, you wrote this when you were serving yourself as an intelligence officer. Did you feel torn loyalties between writing about it and being faithful to a cause which ultimately does depend on secrecy?
I knew that it was a document that was going to paint the picture very black. I submitted it to my service for clearance, and because they knew that it was not drawn from authentic experience, they let it through, and they were very decent about
it.
Yeah, it wasn't my world. I mean, whatever I did there, I certainly was not responsible for running East German agents and people of that kind. So I had no position there. But equally, it was impossible to move in diplomatic or official circles without a considerable awareness of what was going on. And increasingly, the atmosphere of betrayal was very oppressive for the good reason that so many traitors were being unmasked.
Tell me a bit more about your fascination with the character of the spy as a type, because it does seem to drive, as well as this external world that you've described about Germany in the Cold War, it is the characters and their motivation that seems to really drive your interest.
I don't believe there is a definition to be made. I think we're all of us quite aware of the artificial sides of our lives, the moments when we pretend, the moments when we necessarily, often out of courtesy, falsify. I spent a short time in the security services here in Britain and then in overseas intelligence, and I don't look back on those people as being any different from the people in this room.
Could we
perhaps
all be
many
spies?
Of the people in this room have been in that world. It's a very English situation.
It's possible, but not so easy to spot from here.
I bet you everybody here has got at least an aunt or a cousin or an uncle who has done a little of this or a little of that.
But is your proposition that we could, in the right circumstances, all be spies? Or is it, as I had perhaps taken a bit from your work, particularly the earlier work, a sort of type of person who's attracted to it?
There are all sorts of factors at work. In this country, still, amazingly, if you bang on the door of the average householder and say, I work for British intelligence, we need to use your top floor to look out of the window, can't tell you why. Most people say, once they're satisfied by your identity, okay, go upstairs. Don't mess with my daughter's room or something like that. But we, all of us, instinctively incline towards the conspiratorial moment and, quite simply, the patriotic moment. We do have it. So the Brits are very easily recruited, and it goes right back to imperial times when we had the thin red line of the East India Company and so on. We had to learn to divide princes against one another, and we lived in a world of deceit. Add to that the public school system, and you have a complete conspiracy.
Well, let's fast forward now at that very useful point through the Cold War, its end and its aftermath to 9/11, and we come bang up to date in your writing with A Delicate Truth, your latest novel, which paints a very critical picture of the spying game and the new moral challenges of the secret state today. Let's have a flavour of it. Here, a former senior civil servant is trying to alert the authorities to the bad behaviour of a private security contractor whose covert operation, codenamed Wildlife, has gone badly wrong.
We have a new set of rules since your day for cases where sensitive issues are involved. Some already in place, and others, we trust, imminent. And very unfortunately, Wildlife does tick a lot of those boxes, which would mean, I'm afraid, that any inquiry would take place behind closed doors. And should it find against you, and should you elect to bring a suit, which would naturally be your good right, then the resulting hearing would be conducted by a hand-picked and very carefully briefed group of approved lawyers, some of whom would obviously do their best to speak for you, and others not so for you. And you, the claimant, as he or she is rather whimsically called, would, I'm afraid, be banished from the court. while the government presented its case to the judge without the inconvenience of a direct challenge by you or your representative. And under the rules currently being discussed, the very fact that a hearing is being conducted might of itself be kept secret, as, of course, in that case, would the judgment.
What do you make, John, of current responses to the rise of violent Islamic extremism and the opportunity that it gives secret services to lobby governments for exceptions to general constitutional practice in the West, like the secret courts?
I think that there is a great danger, and I suspect we all of it feel that in this room, that anti-terror is becoming a catch-all for all sorts of draconian things that suit the government, suit the administration, but actually limit our personal freedom in a most dangerous way.
Well, you say that we all feel it, but clearly not everybody does, and some people do feel that the threat does justify states taking extraordinary measures. I mean, Ken Clark, hardly the most rapacious or pro-American minister, just to finish the point, he has defended the secret court proposal, saying this is sometimes the only practical means of delivering justice where otherwise there would be none.
Well, that's his view. I don't share it. I think there's quite enough legislation in place for secret, for parts of a trial to be held in secret. That's been going on for years and years. I don't think we need to bow, in this case, to American pressure. The whole issue is how quickly can we enact legislation to prevent information reaching the public about American methods of interrogation during the worst Bush years? And that's so embarrassing. And the relationship between the two intelligence services is so close that we can't let that happen. That is the perception of the government. So rush to legislation.
The suggestion in the book is that the relationship between the Foreign Office and the sort of formal face of the British state abroad and the security services got far too close. They're too much in cahoots. Do you think that really that has got worse at the moment?
Yes, I do. I'll tell you why. Let's take the United States for a moment. It's now estimated that in the District of Columbia alone, nearly 1 million people who are non-governmental are cleared for secret and top-secret work associations. There is a circle of insiders growing and growing and growing.
But what about in this country?
In this country, it's absolutely the same. The intelligence community is getting too big for its boots.
There is a phrase which hits the nail on the head in your latest novel, A Delicate Truth. The most feared creature of our contemporary world, the solitary decider. This is someone who is a keeper of secrets and decides to tell all. Vivid cases have been in the news, and one that you couldn't have known about, of course, when you wrote it, Edward Snowden. How do you judge Edward Snowden and the moral conundrum of what he's done?
Well, I guess, first of all, I wish that Obama had abrogated the Espionage Act so that he wouldn't be in this bind. The thing is that there is not a decent democracy in the world that doesn't need whistleblowers. We all know that. We all know they produce, they're a necessary function. The problem comes when this particular whistleblower comes out of the intelligence corporate establishment and hugely embarrasses corporations that have been promising us privacy. They suddenly find they've got their pants around their ankles. And hugely embarrasses the American government.
How do you feel about him? Do you feel that
he's
done
something
about it
heroic? Myself? I think that, there are whistleblowers like Daniel Ellsberg, who blew the whistle on the Pentagon Papers, who are now national heroes. We've had a few whistleblowers here who've got off scot-free, who've emerged from MI5, for instance, reported that MI5 was spying on the unions, if you remember that one.
So should Snowden get off scot-free?
But I think, generally speaking, if you're a whistleblower, you go in with your eyes wide open, and you know that you're going to have to take the rap. You may get away with it, but it's unlikely. What I do find extraordinary is that when Snowden elected to take this course, that he decided to go to Hong Kong, that the people to whom he was blowing his whistle, in this case the Guardian newspaper, did not take him on, as one would normally, an informant, and look after his welfare later. I don't know whether they discussed that with him. I don't know
You think the Guardian is culpable for not doing that?
Well, if I were running a newspaper and somebody came to me and he said, I want to give you the crown jewels on American eavesdropping, espionage, and so on, I would say, well, what happens when we've blown the whistle? What's going to become of you? I don't want to see you hanging from the gallows. I don't understand what happened.
I don't understand what the deal was. About to be hanging from the gallows, but there's clearly a rather difficult situation in which he ends up talking to the Chinese, saying things in Moscow which can be, at least, or being understood in America as endangering their national security. So isn't he a bit of a mixed blessing?
I'm not condoning what he's done. I would imagine that in the United States it absolutely conflicts with the Bill of Rights, if not the American Constitution, the stuff that he's revealed. But if you elect to become a whistleblower, then either you say you're going to face the music, which is what he said initially, or you find somewhere safe to go and live. I don't understand. I just don't get the Hong Kong element, now the Moscow element.
There is a great German word, and you're an excellent German speaker, so you know it, and it's Alterszorn, the rage of age, of getting old. Is there a danger that anger about the state of the world tips over into polemic, and are you ever guilty of that?
Well, if it's Alterszorn, I was definitely prematurely old. but I don't think I've changed at all.
Just different targets. And something that interested me, just reading back over your work of 50 years, quite an extraordinary different portrait of England that emerges from that, never mind the wider world and the derring do. There's a kind of study of an Englishman who you've been making for many years now. I mean, what have you learned about the changing nature of England and Englishmen?
Well, I've learned it through my children and my grandchildren, I suppose.
We're
educated
country?
By them.
Is it a different country?
It's a different country, to a point. I think the most vexatious thing is how little different it is in so many ways. When I ran away from my public school, I was being told that I was the last generation. That was in 1945, 46, and it was the Attlee government. And we were only going to have one kind of school in Britain, be like other countries. I used to imagine that we would have no monarchy, that the class system would disappear, that there would be somehow a greater coming together of ordinary people. And actually, looking back, I never saw that happen. And somehow or another, in our own strange British way, we've kept the old order intact. And just look at the constitution of our cabinet. I mean, when I was teaching at Eton, we had, I think, 12 or 13 members of the cabinet who were Old Etonians. And I thought, this can never happen again. Now we have an Old Etonian London mayor, we have an Old Etonian prime minister, and they're scattered across the cabinet just as they used to be.
Is that something that amuses you? You look rather wry when you say that, or do you think that it's wrong?
I think it's wrong to allow that structure to remain and then boast about equality of opportunity. That's ridiculous. I think a sober abolition, a sober integration of the educational system would be socially useful. I think it would make us all much happier. And these poor people who are on the edge of being able to afford private education and then drain themselves of their money so that they can send their children to better schools and so on, wouldn't have that agony. I mean, I'm sorry for those people too. It isn't a socialistic perception, it's a simple humanitarian one. Incidentally, Michael Gove, in some piece, wrote recently that I was a lefty. Did you know that? I jolly nearly sued him. Crikey.
Mr. Gove, if you are listening, what would you like to be described as if not a lefty?
I would like to be described as a crossbencher, a free thinker of the old sort. I suppose I sometimes favour the liberal element in the Conservative Party. I'm an absolute, I hop from bench to bench, and I take case by case in life. It isn't that I have some doctrinaire position I'm trying to illustrate. It's trying to see things in a wide-eyed way and turn them into fable.
Well, then we must leave the secret ways of the world. My thanks to John le Carré for his insights and to our reader, John Shrapnel.
And that was Anne McElvoy in conversation with John le Carré with readings from John Shrapnel. And the producer was Luke Mulhall. And you will be able to watch a video of that interview with John le Carré on the Proms Plus website from tomorrow morning. Well worth another listen and a watch, I would say. Well, you can hear the Prommers asking for contributions as we come back into the hall for tonight's prom. Here at the Royal Albert Hall, we've been enjoying the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Thomas Sondergaard. We heard a new work, first of all, and then we heard Prokofiev's second violin concerto. The BBC National Orchestra of Wales, their players are already on stage. They're getting ready to perform Shostakovich's 11th Symphony in G minor next, otherwise known as the year 1905. It was written in the mid-1950s for the 50th anniversary of the October Revolution, the failed uprising of 1905, which was brutally put down by the troops of Tsar Nicholas II. The work features revolutionary songs of the time, and that was enough to satisfy the authorities in the 1950s that Shostakovich was towing the Communist Party line and celebrating the humiliated survivors of that revolution and the fact that they had become even more determined to rise up successfully in 1917. But in fact, there has always been doubt about the tone of this symphony. Had Shostakovich really sold out, or was it rather a rage against tyranny in general, grief for sufferings past? Well, earlier I asked tonight's conductor, Thomas Sondergaard, about his relationship with this piece.
It's a symphony that I've adored since I heard it and since I studied the score the first time. And just reading about the story, knowing about Shostakovich's life, it's just a symphony that's followed me, and it's a piece that touches me so much every time I'm doing it. Actually, on the paper, it doesn't look so alive as it becomes when it's played. And I was reminded of this again when we did the rehearsals in Cardiff. This is our first Shostakovich symphony together, and I'm very thrilled of doing it with them.
Now, I just want you to take off your conductor's hat for 1 minute and put your percussionist hat on. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts about the sounds we're going to hear from the back of the stage.
It's difficult to put words on, but if you had a little camera right before the climax for the percussion and if you filmed me from in front, I think you'd be really scared. Because the way that I want them to have the right sound for the climax, that tells everything, I really think. And it's not only about the volume of what they're doing, but it's the attack. It's this inhuman atmosphere that this instrument section makes. I'd much rather say that. Because in a way, it's not percussion. It's fear. And it's power. It's amazing to have the opportunity to bring across this kind of sound in a huge hall like this. And if that really gets to the last row, then we've achieved what we want.
So listen out for that at the very end and imagine the fearsome face of conductor Thomas Sondergaard. Well, the symphony is in four movements. We have the first movement, the Adagio, which is called Palace Square, and then an Allegro called the 9th of January. The third movement is another Adagio called Eternal Memory. And then the fourth movement, the Alarm Bell, is an Allegro non troppo, followed by an Adagio, and then another Allegro. Well, the members of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales are poised, they are tuned, the audience is primed, and we await the arrival of Thomas Sondergaard for a work which, as you mentioned in the clip there, it's the first time he's performed Shostakovich with his orchestra, the National Orchestra of Wales, but it's a relationship, I think, between the composer and the orchestra and conductor which is going to be a very fruitful one over the next season. So here he is coming to the stage now, Thomas Sondergaard, to perform Shostakovich's 11th Symphony in G minor, the year 1905, with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
phenomenally dramatic finale there to Shostakovich's 11th symphony. We have audience on their feet all around the Royal Albert Hall, cheering and applauding that performance by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by their new chief conductor, Danish Thomas Sondergaard. Look at my face, he said, before I bring in the bells at the end of that finale. And my goodness, from where I was sitting, he looked very fierce indeed. The whole symphony conducted by Thomas Sondergaard with enormous intensity and controlled vigour. He's just come back on to take another bow. He's bringing the cor anglais player to her feet, Sarah Jane Porsmuger. The entire woodwind section being brought up gradually. And I suspect the most principals in the orchestra are going to be brought to their feet, much to the delight of the audience. He said to me earlier that that battle of the bells for him at the end of the symphony absolutely summed up the conflict in this symphony. And as the timpanist just been brought to his feet there, and the rest of the percussion section, you can hear the reaction. The battle between major and minor, you've heard there. And the whole orchestra on their feet now, including principal cellist John Center, who's leaving the BBC National Orchestra of Wales after 37 years, and this is his last prom. What a way to end your career with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. Well, next, we're going to be able to hear this orchestra at the proms under the baton of David Atherton, who's going to be conducting the Vaughan Williams London Symphony, and the world premiere of Nishat Khan's Concerto for Sitar. And that will be broadcast not just on BBC Radio 3, but on the Asian Network as well. So that's the next time you'll be able to hear this orchestra. But I think that is it from us from this prom. There's more to come in the hall. At 10:15, the late night prom is going to feature a cappella group Naturally 7. I heard them earlier today. It is not to be missed. In fact, if you'd like to see an interview with the group, it is up on the website now. But in the meantime, as the cheers and the stamping continue for Thomas Sondergaard and his BBC National Orchestra of Wales and their performance of Shostakovich 11, it is time for me to say goodbye and hand you back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House.
Katie, thank you very much indeed. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall for the first of our proms for this evening. We'll be back there at 10:15 tonight for a live concert by a cappella group, Naturally 7. They'll be performing all manner of material by themselves and some classics too, including While My Guitar Gently Weeps. We're there at 10:15 at the Royal Albert Hall. And Daniel Harding brings the Mahler Chamber Orchestra to the proms tomorrow night in a programme which explores the subtle different properties of the keys of C major and C minor. Two symphonies in C, one by Schumann, his second, and one by Sibelius, his seventh, and then two pieces by Mozart, his piano concerto number 25 in C major, with the soloist Paul Lewis, and to begin, Mozart's Masonic funeral music, Shifting the Mood, by being in C minor. That's all tomorrow at the Proms, live here on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30. Don't forget that you can hear tonight's prom this evening. We've just heard it, but if you'd like to hear it any time over the next 7 days, you can go to the Radio 3 website and choose the Listen Again facility, or you can listen in to Radio 3 tomorrow afternoon when it's our featured prom in the Proms Repeat programme during afternoon on 2 o'clock tomorrow. 9:27 is the time now. Next tonight, A.L. Kennedy considers whether you have to be mad to be a creative genius. It's become a bit of a cliche that there's a link between madness and creativity, but is there any truth in that? You can find out, as indeed she does, by talking to psychologists and psychotherapists, writers, actors, musicians and patients in Art and Madness. That begins in a couple of minutes' time at 9:30 tonight.
Maybe I'm naive, but I think this music almost doesn't need any pre-concert talk. Just be open to the music, just open your mind and open your heart and enjoy this greatest piece.
On Radio 3, pianist Nikolai Lugansky plays Rachmaninoff at the BBC Proms. Join me, Clemency Burton-Hill, on Friday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Should be good. Let's take you to our feature this evening with music by Lutosławski. This is one of his dance preludes for piano and clarinet. A dance prelude by Witold Lutosławski. Gervais de Paia was the clarinetist. Gwyneth Pryor was at the piano. Well, now on Radio 3, the writer A.L. Kennedy questions the clichéd link between madness and creativity. The ancient Greeks considered artists to suffer from a divine madness. The Romantics believed extreme states could bring them closer to the sublime. Since time immemorial, there's been a commonly held conviction that artists need to be constantly on the brink. But is there any truth in this? Here's A.L. Kennedy.
Art and madness. We seem to believe they belong together. Not sport and madness. Not banking and madness. Although many of us might have opinions about the sanity of markets and some bankers' behaviour. The idea that endures, the one you can make documentaries about, is the one that links madness with art. As a woman writer, mad dead Sylvia Plath and mad dead Virginia Woolf are supposed to be my role models. The media still love Ernest Hemingway, Vincent van Gogh, Franz Schubert, the artists who clearly suffered for all the fun they might have had. We are apparently obsessed by mad, dead idols, fascinated by dysfunction and a myth which possibly trivialises mental illness and marginalises art. As an arts practitioner and someone who enjoys other people's art, I want to know why.
I thought I was even going to school by the time my mother was first taken off to the loony bin, and they thought it was diphtheria because she was hallucinating and all sorts of, they thought. Because I remember the ambulance men coming up and fumigating the house, thinking she was feverish from diphtheria.
Painter John Byrne, talking about his mother's mental illness. His childhood experience made it very clear to him that severe mental distress was something other than creative, that working with your mind in pieces would be like running with a broken leg. We'll hear more from John later. But do we connect art and madness because we don't quite know what we mean when we say madness? Should we start with a description of how the mind works when it's well?
Our brains are such that we cannot see reality directly. It's impossible for us to do that. All we can do is be aware of the ideas that our brain creates.
Dorothy Rowe is a psychologist and writer now in her 80s. She has studied the mind and depression for many years.
These ideas come out of our past experience, but they're just ideas. Like, for instance, I'm sitting here talking to you. When you arrived, I guessed that you were the same person that I met back in May, but I can't prove that you're the same person. So that all our brain creates is guesses about what's going on. And out of these guesses, each of us develops a complex of ideas that we call I, me, myself.
Dorothy is a remarkably comforting presence, but what she's saying might be alarming. That reality is merely a story we tell ourselves, that our appreciation of it has to be, in a way, a creative rather than a passive act. That's bewildering. How do we know what is really is? But then again, any story can be rewritten, so maybe we can reframe reality, get creative. Does the story of the mad artist rob us of that potential? Does it warn us against creativity? Or are we allowed to be creative but not too creative, not too extreme? Historically speaking, the first artists were probably at least partly religious or magical figures. They were inspired by unknowns, gods, ancestors, spirits, angels. This was special, but not an illness. Plato, like many Greek thinkers, believed artists' inspirations opened them to the irrational. This still wasn't a medical problem, but was divine madness and dangerous. Yet Socrates reportedly felt philosophy was inspired, like poetry. Plato could be deeply mystical, and some philosophers lived in a manner we might find artistic, questioning everything, politically troublesome, sexually unconventional, emotionally charged. Nevertheless, later cultures chose to embrace Plato's Puritan side and the Greeks' love of moderation, and to find the arts psychologically suspect and too extreme.
Honestly, genuinely, I have never met anyone who isn't slightly tilting to the left mentally. I really haven't. So I think it is a huge myth that artists or musicians or creative people are mad.
The concert pianist James Rhodes. But he would defend the sanity of artists, wouldn't he? He's an artist. In fact, his story and the wider story of madness and art are more complicated than that, as we'll hear.
I must watch out for my nerves. I'm getting haggard, I know. If I go on this way, some day or other there may be a crisis. Yet I can't stop.
Kirk Douglas's portrayal of Van Gogh in Lust for Life. In the scenarios Hollywood favours, practising painting, say, or prose, produces similar casualty figures to serving in Vietnam.
And the pictures come to me as in a dream with a terrible lucidity.
According to the Dead Poets Society, for every English class imbued with a love of literature, we can expect one death. Why? There's something that can give us so much joy. Singing in a choir, singing along to the stones, the pictures on our walls, on our T-shirts, the words that sum up what we sometimes can't quite say ourselves. Why must all these beauties be a threat? But we'll begin in a hotel. We can check in together because this isn't real. It's my memory of a hotel and some sound effects creating a hotel experience we can share. They're working the way that art works, letting you be here with me, even though you're not. So, I'm walking to reception with more than a tilt to the left because I have labyrinthitis, a problem with the inner ear. Symptoms including inexplicable noises, dizziness, nausea, and profound anxiety caused by inexplicable noises, dizziness, and nausea. It's one of the many afflictions ascribed to Vincent van Gogh.
Miss Kennedy, are you checking in?
To the woman at the desk, I probably just look stoned. Rock and roll without the glamour. Plus, I am asking for the nearest chemist. Very suspect. In fact, I just need motion sickness tablets. And I want to explain that I'm a reputable person with a profession, but then I can't. I can't say I'm a writer. In this country, I know that would only increase her suspicions of extremity, addiction, madness. I am suddenly ashamed of what I do. So I just go upstairs. Let's try that.
Going up.
Awkward elevator.
Doors closing.
Wobbly corridor. And give myself up to a spinning bed. And anxiety. I fret about whatever passes through my mind. Loved ones, futures, even writing. Has my long-term exposure to an art harmed me? I am certainly self-pityingly upset and very much the image of Hollywood's average artist, theatrically tormented and horizontal. But it doesn't do to brood. Best get out and find more information.
There are a great many people who have self-classified themselves as mad, who have never produced anything which we would call art.
This is Lisa Epignanese, academic, author, and specialist in the history of mental illness.
There are a great many more people who suffer from mental illness, if you like, than there are people who are either published writers or shown painters or any of the other professions that you can talk about. So there is no direct link. There may, in cases, be linkage. In other words, there are people who have suffered breakdowns of various kinds, who've had what we would now call cyclical depression or cyclical illness, who have produced wonderful novels, poems, and so on.
So, like hairdressers and plumbers, artists can go through bad times. But why do we insist that bad times will be inevitable for artists? Dorothy Rose sees the idea of torment partly as an excuse for would-be artists to be unproductive.
A lot of people like that idea because it excuses you not being creative. If only I didn't suffer this terrible burden of creativity, which means I have to be mad or disturbed or just be myself, a pain to everybody, then that explains why I haven't produced the great British novel or whatever.
I will admit I did wear black and sit alone in coffee shops a lot when I was younger. It's a time-honoured tradition.
In the 16th and 17th century is often known among scholars of the period as an age of melancholy, an age of great sadness. Part of this is because there's so many books written about the topic in the period, the most famous being Robert Burton's The Anatomy of Melancholy.
Dr. Aaron Sullivan is a cultural historian based at Birmingham University's Shakespeare Institute.
There are certain kinds of ways of dressing, like wearing black clothing, certain kinds of ways of standing, often standing apart from other people, perhaps with arms crossed, if you're a man and you're wearing a hat, with your hat pulled down low. And this is joked about in literature from the period, certainly in letters written by people at university in the 1580s, things like that, making fun of the kind of posturing of their melancholic colleagues. But it's still also persistent. There's still a very serious side of it and an interest in people who identify as men or women of letters because it does seem to bring them some social and intellectual esteem.
In the days of Shakespeare, wearing black meant you could afford to. It was an expensive colour. Being miserable meant you had the time to. Shakespeare is less than sympathetic to those besotted with their own misery, and his portrayals of madness don't associate it with art. He shows us Lear finally seeing the truth of human nature. Hamlet is the funniest, sanest guy in the room, acting out in an insane situation. He has the power to transcend the cliché and make us consider the insanity of the world, not the artist. Lady Macbeth is maddened by destruction, not creation. And then there's Ophelia. Self-harming, embarrassing, and then just a hazard to shipping. The girls don't quite get the breaks. The 18th and 19th centuries brought us the capital R romantic model. Poets like Keats and Wordsworth, composers like Beethoven, Schubert, threw off that ancient Greek restraint and got back to mainline inspiration, ecstasy. They plunged into unconventional thinking and behaviour.
I think madness and the arts came very, very close together during the high moment of Romanticism. And it's quite clear that Coleridge, with all his experimentation with drugs in France, Baudelaire, various poets, I mean, all of them enacted varieties of madness and linked it to seeing the world differently through their art. If you like, it was their modern moment. It's quite clear that extreme states, experiences of the sublime, of that which takes you over, as the sublime does, of possession, of a strange kind of openness to being invaded by the outside, is very much admired and is an emotion to be pursued.